sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. April 4th, 1968, was the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. According to the outcome of the 1999 trial brought by the King family, Martin Luther King's assassination was a state crime against democracy, or a SCAD. Here's what Professors Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff of Project Censored had to say in a March 2010 article posted on globalresearch.ca called State Crime Against Democracy. New research in the journal American Behavioral Scientist, Sage Publications, February 2010, addresses the concept of state crimes against democracy, or SCAD. Professor Lance DeHaven-Smith from Florida State University writes that SCADs involve high-level government officials, often in combination with private interests, that engage in covert activities for political advantages and power. Proven SCADs since World War II include McCarthyism, Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, burglary of the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, Florida's 2000 election, and fixed intelligence on WMDs to justify the Iraq War. Other suspected SCADs include the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald, the shooting of George Wallace, the October surprise near the end of the Carter presidency, military-grade anthrax mailed to Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy, Martin Luther King's assassination, and the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 on September 11, 2001. The proven SCADs have a long trail of congressional hearings, public records, and academic research establishing the truth of the activities. The suspected SCADs listed above have substantial evidence of covert actions with countervailing deniability that tend to leave the facts in dispute. The term conspiracy theory is often used to denigrate and discredit inquiry into the veracity of suspected SCADs. Labeling SCAD research as conspiracy theory is an effective method of preventing ongoing investigation from being reported in the corporate media and keep them outside of broader public scrutiny. Psychologist Laurie Manuel, University of Guelph, addresses the psychological advantage that SCAD actors hold in the public sphere. Manuel, writing in American Behavioral Science, states, "Research shows that people are far less willing to examine information that disputes rather than confirms their beliefs. Pre-existing beliefs can interfere with SCAD's inquiry, especially in regards to September 11, 2001. Since this month marks the 44th anniversary of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, I'm going to replay part of a show that aired in early 2009 about that trial and other SCADs. So here's part of that earlier show. Since we just celebrated Martin Luther King Day in many communities around Connecticut, I thought I would share with you something that's not widely known, something that I've never read in a corporate newspaper and I've never seen on corporate television news either. A civil trial was held in November of 1999 that found that James Earl Ray actually didn't kill Martin Luther King. And the trial uncovered who actually did. And it turns out it was a conspiracy. Attorney William Pepper represented the King family in the trial and then wrote a book about the trial, including all of the evidence, called An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. Here's what it says on the inside jacket of the book. On the evening of April 4, 1968, Martin Luther King was in Memphis supporting a workers' strike. By the end of the day, top-level army snipers were in position to knock him out if ordered. Two military officers were in place on the roof of a fire station near the Lorraine Motel to photograph the events. Two black firemen had been ordered not to report to duty that day, and a black Memphis Police Department detective on surveillance duty in the fire station was physically removed from his post and taken home. Dr. King's room at the motel was changed from a secluded ground floor room to number 306 on the balcony. Boyd Jowers, owner of Jim's Grill, which backed onto the motel from the other side of the street, had already received $100,000 in cash for his agreement to participate in the assassination. He was to go out into the brush area behind the grill with the shooter and take possession of the gun immediately after the fatal shot was fired. When the dust settled, King had been hit, and a cleanup procedure was immediately set in motion. James Earl Ray was effectively framed, the snipers dispersed, any witnesses who could not be controlled were killed, and the crime scene was destroyed. William Pepper, attorney and friend of Dr. King and the King family, became convinced after years of investigation that not only was Ray not the shooter, but that King had been targeted as part of a larger conspiracy to stop the anti-war movement and to prevent King from gaining momentum in his promising Poor People's Campaign. 10 years into the investigation, in 1988, Pepper agreed to represent Ray. While he was never able to successfully appeal the sentence before Ray's death, he was able to build an airtight case against the real perpetrators. In 1999, Lloyd Jowers and co-conspirators were brought to trial in a wrongful death civil action suit on behalf of the King family. 70 witnesses set out the details of a conspiracy in a plot to murder King that involved J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, Richard Helms and the CIA, the military, the local Memphis police, and organized crime figures from New Orleans and Memphis. The evidence was unimpeachable. The jury took an hour to find for the King family. But the silence following these shocking revelations was deafening. Like the pattern during all the investigations of the assassination throughout the years, no major media outlet would cover the story. It was effectively buried. Until now, the details, evidence, and personalities of all these nefarious characters have gone unreported. In an act of state, you finally have the truth before you, how the United States government effectively shut down one of the most galvanizing movements for social change by stopping its leader dead in his tracks. The book about this trial came out in 2003, and again, the title is An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, by William Pepper. And now here's some background information about attorney William Pepper. Dr. William Pepper is a barrister in the United Kingdom and admitted to the bar in numerous jurisdictions in the United States of America. His primary work is international commercial law and practices international human rights law from London. Dr. Pepper convened a seminar on international human rights at Oxford University. He has represented governments in the Middle East, Africa, South America, and Asia. Dr. Pepper has lectured at many universities and has been interviewed on many major news programs. Dr. Pepper was a friend of Dr. Martin Luther King in the last year of his life. He is the author of 4 books, including An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, Jr. Today you're going to hear part of a speech that Dr. Pepper gave at the symposium in November of 2007, called 9/11 Family Members, First Responders, and Experts Speak Out. That was held in West Hartford. And so here he is, Dr. William Pepper, discussing Martin Luther King, 9/11, and many other issues. He's talking about the COINTELPRO infiltrating peace groups and other organizations.
To become a part of your movement, and sometimes they will have very radical and very crazy ideas to put forward to the group. They're provocateurs. And for people who have not been politically active over the years, have seen this phenomenon, that all governments do it, it becomes a bit of a shock when the light dawns. So it's very important to be wary of that and to be cautious. That doesn't mean you're being suspicious of your neighbor. It means that you think for yourselves about what you believe in, what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. The most extreme example of provocateurs and provocation that I've experienced was in Chicago, Labor Day in Chicago in 1967, where we held the National Conference for New Politics, and I was executive director of that at Martin King's request. I had been a journalist in Vietnam, as some of you know, and had come back from Vietnam, having been shot down in a C-130 crash landing and had to come back for some treatment. But they were happy to see me go because I was never at the 5 o'clock follies. I was always out in the shelters and orphanages out in the country trying to see what was going on. So I took photographs that eventually appeared on utility poles all over the world, showing burned children and shrapnelized pregnant women and things of that sort that Americans, of course, had never seen before. And Martin King subscribed to a magazine called Ramparts. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Ramparts. But Ramparts ran an article that I wrote in the January issue of 1968. Martin read it. 67, and Martin read it and asked me then to work with him, open all the files I had, which I did, and he wept when he saw some, literally wept when he saw some of the devastation. And then for that last year of his life, only the last year, but for that last year of his life, we worked on, there were two projects, and one primarily was a ticket, a third-party King-Spock ticket, and the National Conference for New Politics brought 5,000 delegates from all over the country. Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party people were there, the SANE Nuclear Society, from the center-left all the way to the radical SDS groups, Hayden and those folks were there. And it was a threat to the Johnson administration, without any question, because Dr. King was who he was, and Dr. Spock, of course, was very popular with whole other segments of the community. And so here we're having this opening night in this convention. Dr. King is to keynote it. And I introduce him and then sit down, and he's into his speech, and someone passes a note over my shoulder to me. And I looked at this note, and it said, "Get him out of here as soon as he finishes speaking, or we will take him hostage and embarrass him before the world." Now, that note was given to me by one of the members of a group called the Black Caucus. The Black Caucus had been formed, and they were organizing every black delegate to the convention to go into a special caucus, which in terms of its purposes and stated goals was fine. But what we were to learn years later was that Black Caucus was, in fact, being honchoed by Blackstone Rangers and gangs and gang leaders and people who were on Daley's poverty payroll for the precise purpose of breaking up the convention and splitting it. So we had no idea about this. So Dr. King finished his speech, and we had to get him out of there. The risk was too great with these people. The rest of the convention was wrecked because one resolution after another was introduced with the precise purpose of dividing one organization against another and splitting apart that movement. And Dr. King was a unifier, and he had to be removed so that division could take place. So that kind of activity goes on. It goes on today, and I just ask you to please to be aware of it and look out for it in terms of your own work. Now, I guess one of the tasks that I undertake in these kinds of sessions is to bring 9/11 into a much broader context, because it could be very easy for people who are for the first time becoming politically active and who are outraged about the atrocity of 9/11 and government malfeasance and cover-up and all the rest of that to see 9/11 as standing alone. Well, it is a seminal issue. In our lifetime, maybe the most important seminal issue, no question about it. But you have to see it in a total context of governmental operations. Understand, this is not the first time that government or governments try to put people under stress and anxiety and justify oppression where they deprive liberty and deny a constitutional, even its very existence in some instances. This is not the first time that's happened, and it's not the first time that it's been attempted to be happened. Cynthia mentioned Northwoods. Many of you may know what Northwoods is. Some of you may not know what Northwoods is. Northwoods, of course, was Admiral Lemnitzer's grand plan to have United States Special Forces operatives dressed as and impersonating Cubans in a variety of city streets and selectively killing Americans to justify the invasion of Cuba. That was in 1959. Lemnitzer worked that plan up under John Foster Dulles. Well, when of course it was put on Kennedy's desk, and when he was elected, and he said, "What are these guys, nuts? Are they crazy? What's going on with these idiots?" And of course, Kennedy threw that plan into the waste paper basket. Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City is another example, I think, of a situation where there was $3 billion locked in counterterrorism legislation, had been locked there for a period of time, had been blocked, had not been allocated. Oklahoma City bombing takes place, the building comes down, all that money gets released, and there are jobs for the boys and money for the well-connected and the cronies as a result of that. You know, McVeigh blew the front off that building with his fertilizer, and he thought he did it. He thought that he actually did it. When I was in London, somebody sent me these rolled up sheets of paper, and I assumed when I looked at it that it was being sent to me by a member of the Corps of Engineers who had a conscience and who was concerned and who had participated in the wiring. When I went through it, it was the wiring plans for that building. And even today, as time lapses, people will come forward and say, yes, you know, I remember engineers running in there to take out unexploded bombs. So that was another example. World Trade Center 93, I mean, the FBI organized that whole operation. That's not even denied now. And they even said to the to the guys they entrapped, don't worry, these are not real bombs. So governments do these things, don't they? In Russia, I was in Moscow around the time that the apartment buildings, I don't know if you recall that, there were apartment buildings blown up, and the word immediately went out from the Kremlin that it were the Chechens. And that they used that as a means and as a rationale for invading Chechnya and doing what they have done to the Chechen people and to the what was once a formidable city, Grozny, just destroying it. And at that point in time, friends of mine there said very clearly, this is an intelligence operation, this is an inside job, and they're about this in order to get into Chechnya and to use it for that purpose. There is the Berlin Disco. I mean, the Berlin Disco was laid at Gaddafi's door, like many things are laid at Gaddafi's door. We change scapegoats, don't we, from decade to decade. And, of course, Gaddafi has been a major scapegoat. And so Berlin Disco was laid at his door. But the German authorities had no hard evidence at all that the Libyans were involved. And that was used as a reason for the shelling, the missile shelling of Gaddafi's home in Tripoli and the killing of his four-year-old daughter. When I went to Libya with President Chavez, we went through that demolished residence of Gaddafi's, and he hadn't touched a slab of cement. He left it just exactly the way it was following the bombardment and the loss of his daughter. So we have those situations, and in an imperialist way, what do we need to look at? We stole half of Mexico, didn't we? Huh? Polk's found a reason to justify the invasion of Mexico, and voila, we have Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, good parts of Southern California, and the Mexicans lost half of their country. We did the same thing with rationalized the taking of Cuba, 1898, the ejection of the Spanish in the Spanish-American War, and then we were going to return it. We're going to leave. One petty dictator after another gets put in there and supported and sustained by us until, of course, Fidel comes down from the Sierra Maestra and changes that whole scenario. But how much later, 59 years later, almost 60 years later, did he do that? Well, we've done that. We've done that to the Hawaiians as well. You know, there is a serious problem historically in this country about the use of imperialism and the use of political assassinations, and the use of overthrows, one after another, one after another. That's all kept from you in school. It's kept from us in school. Did you go? I grew up never hearing about any of these things. I'm sure that most of you shared that experience. We have to somehow learn about it on our own eventually. So we have supported oppressive tyrants throughout this hemisphere, some of the worst in Central and South America. I mean, Argentina and Chile are particularly bad horror stories. But that's all pre-Chavez. Chavez is having an impact on that, on the culture of that continent now. Well, they get... There's so much righteous indignation on the part of these... Justifiably on the part of these people. I mean, we overthrow Mossadegh, who's a secular leader, elected leader in Iran. A marvelous guy, but a nationalist. Nationalist, and he wants the Iranian people to have the benefit of Iranian oil. So Anglo-American oil has got to leave. We overthrow Mossadegh. We get him out and we put the Shah in because now he'll make the proper deals in terms of the oil and energy interests. Then we go in the next year to Guatemala, had elected president, okay, Arbenz, and we do the same thing for Arbenz. We overthrow him. And Guatemala has been a nightmare, hasn't it? Ever since. To this day, it's a nightmare. Tomorrow, Molina may be elected president. He was trained at the School of the Americas. He's an American-trained fascist torturer and murderer who now may be elected president once again in Guatemala. So this horrific story goes on and on and on. We support in every way, subsidize in every way, transnational corporations, particularly the agro corporations, send them into the hemisphere, let them destroy the economy, agricultural economy of these people, literally destroy it so that the farmers and their children have to move into the cities and try to find fabricating or other kinds of jobs because they can't compete with American products that are being imported to places like Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. So we destroy their economies, and then when they try to come north to find jobs to feed their families, we have this outrage about these immigrants trying to come here illegally. That double standard is just incredible. It's incredible. So 9/11 relates to all of these things. 9/11 relates to the destruction of the working class in this country. It relates to internal economic problems that are rising faster than the masters here might want them to. And through radicalizing and making people aware of the 9/11 issue, I think it's maybe very well in line for that swath to be cut quite away. We've incarcerated, how many? Over 2 million now, isn't that right? Large percentages, of course, are black and Hispanic. Overwhelming, what is it now, over 90%, I suppose, are on drug-related charges. Medical problems by the rest of the world, but criminalized in the United States. And yet the United States has been historically the largest drug-dealing, drug-trading operation on the planet, in the history of the planet. How little do we recall, remember Mena, Arkansas, and you remember, and Bill Clinton as governor of Arkansas welcoming George Bush's aide to make the deals with respect to the drugs that were smuggled illegally into Mena and then picked up by the Bloods and the Crips and the various gangs and taken to the streets of American cities and sold with 50% of the profit coming for agency covert operations and 50% remaining with the gangs. America's had an ongoing, large drug dealing operation of this sort. And look what we do to the characters who get pushed into that business in the streets and then incarcerated. In the southern states, we have perpetuated slavery, or at least indentured service, haven't we? Because what happens down there when you get sent to prison, or even to the county jails? I've spent time visiting a number of county jails and prisons in the South, and they rent that labor out. And it goes out, as it always went out, to some of the plantations. They may be owned by corporations now rather than individuals, but they rent it out. It goes there. Those guys go out. They work every single day. They have no say about this. So if they're not slaves because they're not physically owned, they're at least indentured servants because they are, in fact, owned, and they have a servitude to the state, for on behalf of the state. So that's not talked about. Not only are these places hellholes, but even their labor is not talked about and how that produces the kind of income that it does. So I think 9/11 exists in that context. It exists in the context of the whole range of executive orders that this president has signed. What you're doing here tonight and what your brothers and sisters in California picketing against Chevron may be doing tomorrow or were doing last week could be called a felony. They could arbitrarily pick you up as they could pick up those people because there is a relationship, particularly in terms of the Chevron people, to the economic reconstruction of Iraq. And if you do anything that harms the economic reconstruction efforts of Iraq, like stopping Chevron, which is a major bidder for the privatization of Iraqi oil, if you try to stop that, you are interfering with the reconstruction of that country. That's a felony. They can pick you up. They will take your house. They will take your cars. They will take all of your assets. And goodness knows what they will then do to you. That's where we've come to in this country at this point. And it's very important to understand that, because it's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse. How is it going to get worse? Well, KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, were given a $385 million contract in February. And they were given a contract for what purpose? To build concentration camps in the United States. Now, there are an additional over 600 facilities that qualify presently for refurbishment for the same purpose. And the slight rationale is, well, if we get a huge influx of thousands and thousands of illegal immigrants, we got to have some place to put them. So we're going to build these camps in strategic areas of the country. Well, how many thousands of illegal immigrants are going to end up in Maine, are going to end up in Indiana, are going to end up in this state, Connecticut? Every state is targeted for these places. So that immediately begins to, even the most skeptical say, well, what's that all about? And if KBR has a $385 million contract as we sit here, you can bet the cost overruns on that will soon appear as they go on. Well, a lot of people will say, a lot of historians, I know some historians will say, but you know, we've been through this before. This is a swinging of the pendulum to the right, and it'll swing back as it always has before. And they point to the Palmer raids and the arrest of Eugene Debs, and he was sentenced to 10 years, and Palmer raids resulted in hundreds of arrests. And after World War I was over, then they were released. What they don't say about that, of course, was that the Bureau of Intelligence, and military intelligence before that, were gathering files on black people in particular across the country, and those files remained right straight on down to the present day, because they regarded black people as being the best target for Communist Party membership, and of course the Russian Revolution had taken place. But World War I is over, so they're released, so that's okay. World War II, we incarcerated 110,000 Japanese. We put them in camps. When World War II was over, then they were released. So people will point to these kinds of situations. We had the McCarthy hearings, and then the Senate turned on Joe McCarthy, and eventually he was discredited. And all of that's true. But there is a qualitative difference now. There is a substantial material difference now. This is a perpetual war. This is not a war that's going to end. This is a war that's going to exist continually. And if there are incidents here or abroad that they can use to heighten anxiety and justify more expenditures, of course they will use them. And if, as you move closer and closer to more explicit types of fascism, they will be justified on the basis of the fact that we are at war. This president continues to say, we are at war. And it is a war that's not going to end, says Rumsfeld. And it'll go on well beyond our lifetimes. They're sowing the seeds for keeping a nation in a militaristic frame of mind, militarizing the culture at every level. Anyone who sees what's going on the streets of urban America sees a quantitative and qualitative change in the way the police are being trained to deal with problems in the streets. We are truly militarizing this society in an unprecedented fashion. And then we come to the next real war. Of course, you know that's Iran. Now there are people saying, no, there's no reason to invade. We really don't need to invade Iran. We can't handle it and all of that, and we shouldn't do it. Well, Nick Burns is Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East, that region. He had some quiet words with some colleagues of mine at Oxford. I convened a seminar on international human rights at Oxford University for 2 years before I took the time off to write a book on Hugo Chavez. And Burns was up there, and he spoke to some of my guys very candidly, and he said, I've been given until December 31st. And if I can't do what Chris Hill did with the North Koreans, get them totally to back down, he said, then it goes to Cheney's boys, and we will be at war. Now, the time frames always, there are variables, and they always change, and maybe a little later than Burns was implying, if something is happening and El Baradei is jumping up and down saying, no, we need more discussions. But I think that war is probably inevitable.
And again, that was part of a speech given by Dr. William Pepper in West Hartford in November of 2007. To hear the complete speech, you can go to the website ct911truth.org, where you can also listen to the first 79 editions of 9/11 Wake Up Call. My more recent shows can be found at radioforall.net, and that's the number 4. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.